crucial, and we hope that everyone will be appearing before the committee to make submission will treat these submissions as such. So I would like to welcome all of you on that note, and also request that those who are going to be making submissions should present themselves to the secretary of the committee, who's sitting here on my right, and indicate that they are present. The procedure would be as follows, that we will allow presenters to make submissions, and then we will allow members of the portfolio committee to ask questions. There may be certain exceptions where we allow either the department or the various legal teams, the people, advisors to ask questions. Those will be in extra circumstances, but in the main, we will be asking the member. We will be allowing members of parliament to ask questions for their own as submissions will be helping us in making the final determination on the legislation. The first submission would be by Professor Darcy Dupont from the Social Law Project in the University of the Western Cape. We would allow him to make his presentation. Bear in mind that we need to allow questions and answer later on. Prof.
Thank you, Chair, and I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to speak to you today and to apologize for my delay in getting here. I have also submitted documents to the committee in which the argument I want to make is more fully set out. Here I want to simply confine myself to the main points. Two small points by way of introduction. One is that submissions on this point were also submitted to NEDLAC when the bill was being debated there. In response to that, the Department of Labour withdrew the proposed Section 11, which I had originally submitted, and replaced it with another one, which they believe would fix the problem. I don't think it does, and that's what my submission is about today. I also want to make the point that although I want to address only one specific question, namely the compliance of the proposed Section 11 of the Employment Equity Act, that is Clause 6 of the Amendment Bill, and the compliance of that provision with Convention 111 of the ILO, in other words, our international law obligations. And I also want to say at the outset that the proposed changes that I am going to raise today are, in my submission, also in compliance with the Constitution. So constitutional compliance does not arise. I simply want to address the problem of compliance with Convention 111. Now, as we know, the Employment Equity Act, the purpose was to give effect to ILO Convention 111, dealing with equality in employment, and the Employment Equity Act must be interpreted in compliance with that convention, which is part of our international law obligations. And the Amendment Bill of 2012, which is before the committee at the moment, was put forward, amongst other things, specifically to ensure that the Act gives effect to our obligations as a member state of the ILO. And my argument will be that as it stands, proposed Section 11 does not give effect to obligations in that it provides employees with less protection against discrimination than that which the convention requires. Now, the main point is that the convention requires member states, including South Africa, therefore, to eliminate all discrimination against employees, not to allow any scope for discrimination against employees, and it then defines discrimination quite specifically and quite clearly, as set out there also on the papers, discrimination means any distinction, exclusion or preference which is based on a prohibited ground, which has the effect of nullifying or impairing equality of opportunity or treatment in employment or occupation. So it does not prevent an employer from treating an employee adversely, for example, dismissing an employee for misconduct, but it does not allow such adverse treatment to happen because of prohibited ground such as race, sex, gender, belief, and the like. That is discrimination. That also is what our constitution set out to root out following 1994. Then the convention does set out three forms of what we call differential treatment or differentiation among employees, which are not included in this type of discrimination. And those are measures based on inherent requirements of a particular job. And the second one is not important for us because in South Africa we did not adopt that one. And thirdly, affirmative action measures. So in other words, if the action taken by the employer is dictated by the nature of the job itself, not by the employee's personal characteristics, but by the nature of the job, you must have a driver's license to drive a truck. That's the requirement. That cannot be discrimination. And likewise, affirmative action measures, for obvious reasons, are excluded from scope of discrimination. That is differential treatment. It is something different. And in terms of the convention, those grounds which you see on the screen are the only possible grounds for member states to allow differential treatment of employees of a negative nature based on which coincide with prohibited grounds. Thus, for example, to take an obvious case, in a recent film made about Madiba, had Charlize Theron applied for the role of Madiba in the film, she could have been excluded and would have been excluded, I think, and that would not have amounted to race discrimination or sex discrimination or age discrimination. It would have been dictated by the inherent requirement of the job of playing that particular part in that particular film. Now, the Employment Equity Act then gives effect to commissioners, as I've mentioned, and Section 6, which is not in contention today, says that no person may unfairly discriminate against an employee on any foreign policy or practice on one or more grounds, and they set out those well-known grounds of prohibited discrimination. And that is fully in compliance with the convention, so that we I don't want to address at all. The problem arises that the term unfair has, with great respect, confused the court in a number of cases, or perhaps some skilled advocate will take a technical point and argue that in court, and that may sway the case if the other side is well prepared. And so, in some cases, the courts have interpreted the notion of unfair discrimination, say on grounds of race or sex, as meaning that therefore it must be possible for an employer to discriminate fairly based on race or sex or anything else. Now that, as I mentioned, the convention does not allow discrimination on those grounds at all. It can never be fair. So that interpretation was clearly in conflict with the convention and also in conflict with Section 3D of the Employment Equity Act, which tells us we must interpret the Act in compliance with the convention. That is interpretation which is not in compliance with the convention but goes against the convention. In Section 6.2 of the Employment Equity Act, gives effect to the exceptions allowed by the convention, namely saying it is not unfair discrimination to take affirmative action measures or to distinguish, exclude, prefer any person based on an inherent requirement of a job. And those are the exact same words of the convention, and that clearly is in compliance with the convention. So part of the problem then arises from the fact that the Employment Equity Act does not define discrimination, nor does the Constitution. It's left to the courts to do so. And in some cases, the courts have interpreted discrimination as having quite a wide open-ended meaning treating employees differently. The argument has been raised by advocates in court and by judges that the dictionary meaning of discrimination is simply to draw a distinction. It says nothing about good or bad. However, as we see, the convention and also our case law have made it quite clear that discrimination in the legal sense does not mean neutral distinctions. It does mean negative, prejudicial treatment. It means, if you like, victimization. And my point, therefore, is victimization can never be fair on the prohibited ground. And so in some cases, in the courts have clearly interpreted discrimination as meaning treating one employee worse than another, and that then again is in compliance with the convention, and that I would suggest then the purpose should be to avoid that kind of confusion by clearly in the act itself guiding the courts as to the meaning of the term. Now the problem then with the proposed amendments. Firstly, the first paragraph of the proposed new section 11.1 is in compliance with the convention. It says that if unfair discrimination is alleged on the ground listed in section 6.1, such as race, sex, belief, and so on, the employer against whom the allegation is made must prove that such discrimination did not take place as alleged. So that is quite clear. And the employer can show that, for example, by showing I did not exclude you because of your race or sex or religion. I excluded you from the job of truck driver because you did not have a driver's license. The fact that you are female or person of a particular racial category was irrelevant. Anybody has to have a license and you did not have it. So that, therefore, falls outside the notion of discrimination altogether. The problem arises with the proposed paragraph B of subsection 1 of the new proposed section 11. That says that a second defense available to an employer against whom unfair discrimination is alleged is to prove that such discrimination is rational and not unfair or is otherwise justifiable. Now, that internationally, if you like, is viewed with astonishment, because it opens the door to discrimination in a negative sense, in a sense of victimization, if you like, on any ground, including prohibited grounds such as race, sex, gender, and so on, if that employer succeeds in persuading the judge or the TCMA commissioner that it's fair to do so. In other words, give those judges and commissioners open-ended discretion to allow discrimination against employees. And as a lawyer, I am the first to admit that decisions are not always correct. Very often the most eloquent advocate may swing it, or subjective perceptions play a role, and it's any amount of difficulty to set right an incorrect decision. Now, the reason advanced in the memorandum that came with the amendments for this proposed new section 11 is to make it consistent with section 13 of the Equality Act. Now, I would suggest, and as I say, I think at NEDLAC it was felt that that would fix the problem. If the Equality Act says so, then surely the Employment Equity Act can do the same. I would suggest that it cannot. Firstly, because the Employment Equity Act must be interpreted in the context of Convention 111, and that does not apply to the Equality Act. The Equality Act deals with equal treatment and so on across the spectrum. For example, it allows for situations, it applies to acts of Parliament, it applies to executive action, it applies to acts by state officials across the board. And many situations arise there where adverse decisions may be based on grounds such as age. For example, the minimum age of voting on the face of it might be taken as discrimination on grounds of age against people who are age 17 or 16. Or driver's licenses, couples ages 18. That does not amount to discrimination, which should not be seen as unfair discrimination against people who are not 18, because there are public policy reasons for those age, and the same for the age of marriage. And so the way in which the Equality Act chooses to address this problem is to say that it can be shown that such discrimination is fair. I would also have issues with that approach. I think that gives way too much, but nevertheless, that is what before us today. But however, what we can say quite definitely is that Convention 111 does not cater for quote, fair discrimination, unquote, on listed grounds in that sense. And the second reason, quite inappropriate, I've already touched on, and that is that those two pieces of legislation apply in completely different spheres. One can't transplant the rationale for the Equality Act to the very specific context of employment, where if the employee complies with the employment contract and the employer has no valid reason for dismissing that employee, really, there is simply no scope for the employer now to prejudice that employee on additional grounds, such as which are irrelevant to the job itself, such as race, sex, gender, religion, and all the like, unless, of course, I mentioned before, those grounds happen to coincide with an inherent requirement of a job. Now, the problem again, and why I personally feel quite strongly about it, is because we have quite a long list of cases by now since the early 1990s on discrimination law. Many of those cases, or at least a significant number of cases, were, to my mind, unfortunately decided on grounds of arguments which the court should not have considered had it applied the Convention, international law, and the Act as it should be, in my opinion. Huge amounts of court time and fees, if you like, legal fees, have been absorbed by arguing those cases where, if the Act had been quite explicit, those arguments would simply not have arisen. Of course, that would have spelled out what the law is. So especially courts tend to be, if you like, swayed by constitutionality. And so if you could argue on what is constitutional, what is not constitutional, and such constitutional court judgments, that tends to carry a lot of weight. The problem is, of course, that the broad constitutional test which applies to Parliament, which applies to the executive, which applies to local government and so on, that does not apply to the employer. The employer is not the state. The employer does not have the powers to differentiate or discriminate, which the state may have. The employer is bound by the employment contract and is also bound by equality law and may not discriminate. And so, in effect, by relying on constitutional court cases dealing with quite different contexts, such as the Insolvency Act and so on, the courts are in effect bypassing the Employment Equity Act and relying on inappropriate external precedent. And itself has said in an important judgment, the New Clicks case, that it is impermissible where you have a statute like the Employment Equity Act dealing with a particular issue, employment equity in this case, to then bypass it and rely, if the court, if you like, to reinterpret the Constitution and ignore what Parliament has said in the Employment Equity Act. I think if this amendment goes through, it would give rise to serious problems. It would undermine the purpose of the Employment Equity Act by allowing extended, undefined scope for employers to discriminate, possibly persuading the judge or the commissioner that what I'm doing is fair, you know, and so on. And this is not simply theoretical. We have seen numerous cases where employers have argued quite passionately that they are entitled to dismiss a pregnant employee. And then they realize, of course, I can't say that she's pregnant. They say, because she did not disclose to me that she was pregnant, it's not her duty at all, or that she was planning to get pregnant. So therefore, I'm not dismissing her because of her pregnancy, but because of something else. Now, the courts should have no difficulty in saying that that is nevertheless a ground related to pregnancy. But now, what if the employer says, okay, it was based on her pregnancy, but I'm a small employer. I can't afford to lose her for 5 months, whatever. So therefore, it's fair for me to terminate their services and replace it with someone else. We've had a judge, the Labour Appeal Court, in the Woolworths versus Whitehead case, stating that it is not difficult to imagine grounds other than inherent job requirements where it would not be unfair to discriminate against an employee, and that was a case dealing with pregnancy. So I think this clause would, in first place, put pregnant employees at grave risk of open-ended discrimination. The same with sexual harassment. We all know the argument, I think, which has been used by employers and by perpetrators of sexual harassment, that she provoked me. the address was too short. You can't blame me. Now, if you have a somewhat conservative commissioner presiding over such an argument, who says that the commissioner might not say, okay, yes, she did actually behave quite provocatively, yes, now maybe you have a point. You harassed her, but therefore it is not discrimination because it is fair discrimination, it's not unfair discrimination. It opens the door to that, and you know, having been through many arbitrations, and I can assure you it is not unrealistic to prepare for the worst, hope for the best, you look at going to court, but prepare for the worst. And of course, the poorest complainants will face the greatest risks because they are the ones who cannot afford to set up commission on review. It may take a deposit of 100,000 rand to go to the labor court for the case review. So that, in this case, women who have suffered sexual harassment and the ruling was made that was fair discrimination, that's the end of the matter. She has no remedy. And that, I think, is a clear denial of the purposes of the Employment Equity Act. Then again, I'll be brief now. Given the divergent views among judges and commissioners, if the section now gives commissioners and judges a free hand to interpret what they regard as fair discrimination, my imagination boggles at the range of decisions that we may well be getting. With one case distinguished from another, and yes, that is fair, no, that is, for this reason, that is no longer fair, and so on. People and employers also won't know what is allowed and what's not allowed. Affirmative action, I think, will become a casualty of this, because based on this approach, which underpins this notion of fair discrimination, the courts in a number of cases have, to my mind, wholly incorrectly, have said affirmative action measures are the form of discrimination in a negative sense, but it is a form of fair discrimination. Or they then proceed to test if it's fair or it's not. Never mind the fact the Constitutional Court in Van Leeuwen case has told us affirmative action measures are not any form of discrimination. It's a fundamental aspect of equality, but actually equality. The courts don't always follow precedent as they should. That is a risk that one tries to eliminate by the way that statutes are phrased to avoid kind of this. So this, however, would mean in the employment context that employers trying to implement affirmative action measures may now be saddled with the duty of having not to prove it's an affirmative action measure, but to prove that it is fair discrimination, which is an entirely different test that will greatly narrow the scope for affirmative action. And last but not least, the provision of the Employment Equity Act Section 2B62B, which provides for inherent requirements of a job as being a justifiable differential treatment that is not discrimination, that will become redundant. Because so far the court's been very strict in testing the reasons given by employers why an inherent requirement of a job to employ a white person or a black person or a male or a female. And as far as I'm aware, in all cases, the courts have found that the alleged inherent requirements of the jobs were not so at all. It was perfectly possible for that person to do the job. It was merely the employer's choice not to have a person doing the job. But now, however, if this goes to as it stands, the employer won't have to prove that it wasn't the requirement of the job. The employer can say, very well, I'm discriminating, but it is fair for me to do so. And if the judge or the commissioner agrees with that, then that would say it would then be a straightforward miscarriage of justice. I could go on to say something about the term unfair discrimination, just in case the committee feels that then why do we have the term unfair? Does it mean, I'm not challenging the term unfair discrimination as such, even though we are the only country in the world to apply that adjective. We inherited that from the apartheid regime as a matter of interest. In the 1980s, they defined fair discrimination as being apartheid because the law allowed it, and unfair discrimination meant discrimination by an employer not covered by an apartheid law. Now that, of course, is completely to be rejected and irrelevant in our present context. After 1993, however, the interim constitution brought back that term in it for a different purpose, to distinguish what we now call discrimination from what we now call mere differentiation. the discrimination in the sense meant any kind of differential treatment, but unfair discrimination meant negative forms of prejudicial forms of treatment. And I would argue that we don't actually need the term unfair to tell us that, because the convention and our case law already tells us that discrimination has a negative meaning. However, we have an open-ended list of grounds of discrimination. Race, sex, gender, and the list of grounds are included, but other grounds, similar grounds, may also be unfair as a basis of discrimination. And so I would argue that the term unfair is a very useful term in that context of covering all those grounds, listed or unlisted, which are impermissible for an employer to discriminate on, and that would bring it in line with Section 187 of the Labour Relations Act, which prohibits automatically unfair dismissal, which also means that dismissal includes dismissal on grounds such as race, sex, religion, and so on, and also for trade union membership and the like. If an employer, if it is shown that that was a reason why the employer dismissed the employee, it is automatically unfair, it can never be fair. And I would argue that protection against discrimination should be equally strong and equally clear, and not allow employers to discriminate on grounds that cannot be fair. So I think the problem in my respectful submission, and I'm only here to suggest for the committee and for Parliament obviously to decide what's best, but in my opinion, the problem could be fixed quite easily in sub-paragraph B, which is where the problem arose, which would allow the employer to prove that discrimination is justifiable or fair, simply to say that the employer would need to prove either that discrimination did not take place as alleged, or that such alleged discrimination, no, it's not discrimination, but alleged discrimination, is justifiable in terms of Section 6.2, which allows for affirmative action measures or in the end job requirements, which are permitted by Convention 111. And I further suggest that much time and effort spent in litigation, not to mention the cost and pressure on the courts, could be avoided if the term discrimination were to be clearly defined. And I would simply, again, this is not making a new ground, simply to once again bring the Act into compliance with Convention 111 and international law obligations, by taking over the relevant parts of the definition contained in Convention 111, namely saying that discrimination means any distinction, exclusion, or preference which has the effect of nullifying or impairing the quality of opportunity or treatment in employment or occupation, excluding any measures taken in terms of Section 62 of the Act, affirmative action measures or the job requirements. And that simply is restating what the Convention already says, but in too many cases the Court have not been made aware of this and have defined discrimination in ways inconsistent with our international law obligations. And finally, this would, in my submission, would clearly be consistent with the Constitution. Legislation becomes unconstitutional, it provides less and the minimum protection allowed by the Constitution. This does not do that. This, in fact, makes much more concrete and strong the protection against discrimination which the Constitution contemplates. The Constitution, in other words, provides a floor of rights, not a ceiling of rights, and this builds on that floor in a way which I think would give employees more effective protection. Thank you.
I was about to stop you because you were going to be unfairly discriminating against other presenters by eating into their time. But thank you for that submission. I would allow honorable members to ask questions, make observations. Honorable Adrian Williams and honorable Modau.
Thanks, Chairperson. I've just got one question. Sorry, are you proposing that Section 11.6b be replaced by such alleged discrimination is justifiable in terms of Section 6.2 of this Act? Or are you proposing that, it's 11.1b, so are you proposing that they add another section so that the term otherwise justifiable stays in the act? Or is it on top of that, or is it replacing it, or is it just adding to that? And my second question is, if the act doesn't define discrimination, it will be in its current form as it is now. And are you saying that we must define this discrimination here only applicable to the equity bill, or is this are there different discriminations? We're going to define it here and then define it differently somewhere else and differently somewhere else, etc., etc. That's what I just want to know what that is. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. My colleague sort of preempted my question, but I'll phrase it differently. Prof, if you were to walk out of here, what would you want in a sentence? What we need to do with it in terms of what he was asking? The other question that I have is that in your submission, you referred frequently to the commissioners, which I presume would be the CCMA commissioners, and the courts. And I know that in some of the submissions, there is argument for commissioners and argument for the labor court. What's your view on that? That's part of it.
Okay. Honorable Master Omule. I think you've switched on the wrong mic. Your sister is the right one, but you're speaking to the wrong one.
Thanks, God. It's not money. There is this argument in the Western Cape. I got encouraged by your mentioning of in certain circumstances, in certain circumstances, affirmative action might be a casualty. There is a very strong argument in the Western Cape, but I'm not very sure whether you heard about it or read about it or followed the story. But in terms of the Western Cape historical background, this should apply differently from the rest of the country. I'm not sure whether, how do we justify that? Specifically in the Western Cape. There's a very strong argument that this is gaining ground. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Nkemba.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let's welcome the submission by Professor. His first public hearing on the amendments of the Employment Equity. The ninth point, Chairperson, I would assume, but the Professor would correct me, I would assume that even if Professor has made comparison with Convention 111 of the ILO, vis-à-vis the current act and what is proposed in this bill in relation to clause 6 of the bill, has the professor also in drafting and considering his submission look at what has been the Employment Equity Commission reporting on since the inception of the Employment Equity? What are the issues that were raised by the Employment Equity Commission? Is his submission also speak to that? Not only citing Convention 111 of the ILO. That's one share. And I think linked to that, because these amendments are not just amendments because people want to bring amendments. In fact, the department wanted to bring amendments in diplomatic.
there has been public hearings that took place in credit care throughout the country, where employers, everybody, that government have made submissions. So have you also taken into account the reports that came as a result of this portfolio committee going around the country trying to establish for both workers and employers which areas in the current labor legislation, but now let me speak to the employment equity bill, which needs to be amended? Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, thank you for those questions. Prof?
Thank you for the questions. I'll deal with the points that they were raised that overlap in some cases between different questions. I'm proposing that the wording that you see on the screen in paragraph B should replace the existing wording, because I think that the wording that you see on the screen does in fact cover the ground that the convention requires and allows to be covered in this context. I'm not aware of anything that could be added to, if you like, expand the justification available to the employer. The proposed definition, need to be inserted in section 1, which is where the definitions are contained. I don't think there's any particular problem with the notion of the Employment Equity Act having its definition of discrimination, because it operates in a very particular context, and in that context discrimination does not mean the same as what it means when Parliament makes laws to amend the marriage laws. In fact, in the Equality Act as well, we find different chapters have different sets of provisions applying in different contexts. So I think, in fact, that's an essential quality of law, is the ability to be specific to address particular contexts, because the moment you have broad, open-ended concepts, that then opens the door to courts to do their own thing. And when it comes to protecting human rights, I don't think one should do that. There are certain areas where certainly it's important to have flexibility, but I don't think that discrimination is one of them. On the question of commissioners versus courts, I'm aware that as it stands now, the proposal is that commissioners of the CCMA should be able to deal with discrimination cases involving sexual harassment or complaints by those earning below a certain threshold. And I think that's entirely fair, because a positive step, in the sense that whatever reservations we may have about the CCMA, which may or may not be justified in many cases, nevertheless, for the vast majority of employees, unless they have a trade union supporting them and agreeing to support them, they simply don't have access to the labour court. It's beyond their means. And that means, and I think there are actually very few discrimination cases relatively to the total caseload of the labour court since 1996. And I think the very important reason for that is that employees of discrimination can't afford to do anything about it. And by allowing employees to take complaints to the CCMA, they're at least gaining a forum from where matters possibly a remit can be fashioned. So I see this as a step forward, and I'm working on the assumption that it will go through. I'm not aware that there's been challenged or questions what are those. There are two questions raised which actually fall beyond my submission. The one was the question of equitable representation, and the question of regional and national demographics. That, of course, is quite a different question from what I'm trying to address in the limited time that I have available, and many other very contentious points one could have raised. It's not only about the Western Cape, it's about any part of the country or any region, if you like, where the national demographics don't apply. And so, at the moment, the open-ended provision is to allow, if that is challenged, to allow the relevant tribunal then to consider whether it's justifiable, and either in terms of national demographics or regional demographics or not at all, for what it's worth, you know, I have to teach this to my students in the past, and I would say to them that when it concerns jobs which are, if you like, nationally advertised, it would make sense to apply national demographics. If you're talking about jobs that are locally advertised, such as jobs at low grades, then the local population will be applying. It seems appropriate then to apply local demographics, but that's only my opinion. It's up to the courts to decide that. The Employment Equity Commission reports, well, they are concerned with employers' compliance with, in essence, Chapter 3 of the Employment Equity Act, namely employment equity plans and all the measures taken in terms of that. And as we all know, the level of or the progress made in those terms, particularly in terms of affirmative action, has been limited and inadequate and raises many questions. But that is not really about unfair discrimination against employees as such. The Commission is not concerned with that, except very, very marginally. The 2010 submissions, well, I was among those who responded to that. But again, Cossato to my knowledge, raise this as a problem that was problematic, namely this question of a too broad defense against discrimination. And Cossato did argue that at NEDAC and also in relation to the current round of amendments, and that I think is the main reason why the original proposal which came forward in 2010 was withdrawn. But I'm not aware that anyone else has raised that issue. Certainly employers have not raised it, but I think the fact that Cossato has raised it, being the largest federation of labor in this country, does tell us something that this is something which needs to be taken seriously.
Okay, thank you. I think also to thank you for your submission. I must say that the issues that you chose to focus on today, the definition of discrimination and the implication for the wording on unfair discrimination, is actually critical and quite often. I think it will help us in our discussions, but also have implications not only for this law, but generally for all the other laws in the country. So, but thank you very much for your submission. We are going to the next submission, Dr. Penny Abbott, from the South African Board for People's Practices. You can come sit here. We'll give you 15 and 20 minutes for your presentation, and then we'll allow questions and answers. All right. And if you could also introduce your delegation. Thank you. to indicate that the CAPES are not going to be making an oral submission, but they are present. They're at the back. They are here just to observe, and that if any of the members want to ask them questions based on the written submission that they've made, you are welcome to do that during tea, which means we will also then have more time to engage with all the other submissions. Dr. Abbott?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. If I can introduce ourselves and then I'll introduce the delegation. Last year we did introduce ourselves briefly, but I'll go through it again as well. The SA Board for Equal Practice is a professional body recognised by SACRA, and our mandate is to ensure professional standards of HR work, and you can see relevant to the subject under discussion today. We are 30 years old and we are the largest HR body in South Africa. Myself, I'm head of research at the SABCC. I have a background in human resource management extensively in South Africa and also internationally. If I can also introduce Mr. Zuko Mangeni, who's the HR manager of Rainbow Chickens in Western Cape and is also, until last night, chair of our Western Cape committee. We also have with us, I'm sorry it's not on the slide, Mr. Jerome Viney, who is a regional committee member of our Western Cape committee and is an academic in business management and HR at the University of Technology. Our interest in employment legislation in general, and this particular, these two bills and amendments acts in particular, we are the workplace implementers of legislation. It's a very large part of an HR practitioner's job. And in terms of our professional duty, we also recognise we have a duty to South African society to advance transformation in the workplace, and we take this extremely seriously. We are in a position to communicate to and support HR professionals when they are implementing legislation. And we are also in a position to conduct research into the effectiveness and implications of legislation. I'm going to come back to that point about research a bit later in this particular context. And our mission really is to raise the professional standards of HR work. And we are, in fact, later this month going to be launching HR management standards, which will support legislation and codes of practice in setting out what organisations should be doing to manage their people resources effectively and help all the employees in organisations to reach their potential. We're just going to make some few comments. We have put in a more detailed written submission, but we want to concentrate on a few points. I'm going to deal very briefly with a couple of points on the Employment Services Bill. We do see that the bill, as in its present form, has some distinct overlaps with other legislation. It is probably inevitable that in labour fields you overlap with the Department of Higher Education and Training, but there are specific overlaps which we think should be addressed in looking at this bill. The bill, in Section 5, looks at advice to workers on access to education and training, and I think we need to be aware of the work that SACRA is doing, in fact very good work in their career centre on exactly this issue, and therefore it would be a pity to introduce an overlap in duplication. In Section 11, we talk about collating employment information. This is also planned as a big focus of the Department of Higher Education and Training, and we know to our detriment that labour market information is scanty, incomplete and completely inadequate. So any initiatives to improve the situation are very welcome, but here's a fairly detailed initiative underway already in the Department of Higher Education and Training, which will be setting up a new labour market research institute, and we think therefore that this provision in this bill should be looked at to avoid overlap. We look at Section 10, the idea to introduce mandatory reporting on vacancies. We think this is an excellent idea in theory, but it could be very disastrous in application. We have a very active private sector employment industry which has spent many years developing itself in this field, and we do think that in this field we could be using public partnerships very well, particularly for scarce skills. I think every HR manager's worst nightmare would be to have to report a vacancy of a casual labourer to the Department of Labour and have 30,000 people turning up on their doorstep next morning. If we now move to the Employment Equity Bill, employment equity is an extremely complex topic, as you well know. For HR practitioners, it's probably the most difficult area of their work. And I will be drawing attention at a couple of points in this presentation. There is a lack of research in this area, which is a concern. We have prepared a very detailed position paper, which I did submit together with our comments, which does go through some of the statistics and some of the reasons for lack of progress. We do know, we always have known, that introducing transformation in employment would be a long-term process. But, as we all know, it is going far too slowly. And as somebody has pointed out fairly recently, Germany and Japan managed to transform their economies completely within a few years after the Second World War. We are 18 years later, not doing too well. So, yes, we are very concerned at the lack of progress. And in our paper, we've identified several key areas for employers to address, because we do recognise that much of the implementation constraints lie with employers. Two of the key constraints are, of course, economic growth and the delivery of the education system. And when we believe that when the Employment Equity Act was put in place in 1998, it was done on the assumption that economic growth would be accelerating and therefore there would be more job opportunities, and that the education system would be delivering people ready for the marketplace. And neither of those two have occurred. If we look at the Employment Equity Commission report, the latest one comments that at the professional level, things are going quite well, but at management level, things are not going so well. Our analysis of the figures doesn't agree with this. We think that at the professional level, things are not going well. It's very good at the skills level, and that is due to a lot of investment in training and education at the lower level. But at the professional level, any transformation does depend on the output of universities, and the figures are showing at the moment that recruitment into the professional level are still more white than others. And until that changes, the future of management levels is not going to change very much. There's a lot of reporting in the newspapers about this mass of unemployed graduates. But actually, if you look at the figures, the unemployed graduates are not B-degree graduates. They are diploma and FET college graduates, and that therefore they're not qualified for entry into the professional level. So the pool available at that level is not growing the way that it should be. We note that the analysis of the statistics in the Employment Equity Commission report is inadequate. If you look at the growth in the number of companies that have successfully reported, this is commendable and shows big effort on the part of the Department of Labour. But it does mean that you cannot analyse trends. You cannot say what has happened over a 10-year period, for example, when the number of reports in the 10th year is double the number of reports in the first year. Your baseball comparison is not the same. So until we stabilise that and carry on for a few more years, it's very difficult to look at the trends. We certainly need more research in that area. And in our submission, we actually said that we believe that the analysis of the employment equity statistics should be done through an agency such as SAP-SA or other bodies who are more equipped to do so. We do believe that the Employment Equity Act in its original state is well drafted. It's got the right emphasis on preventing discrimination and promoting affirmative action. And we wouldn't like to see that the amendments undermine this. The Department of Labour and Employment Equity Commission have concluded that the lack of progress means that we must tighten up the laws. And whilst we don't completely disagree with that, what we say is that we need to work much more on the carrots as well as the sticks. HR people do a lot on performance management, and that means aligning actions to results. And we believe that we need to think a bit more in performance management terms in this line. You can take the horse to the water, but you cannot make it drink. If you look at the six, yes, non-employment, non-compliance employers must face consequences, but we believe there is a very large differentiation to be made between employers who are flagrantly lacking in compliance. They're not submitting plans, so in terms of procedural compliance, they're completely ignoring the law. If you look at the figures, I think it's 1,493 employers who employ more than 150 people are included in the latest report. There must be many more thousands of companies in that size range who are not reporting, and yes, those people need to be brought into compliance. But if we look at the substantive compliance, we believe that there are areas of difference of opinion and should be dealt with differently. Serious non-compliance obviously needs to be prioritised. We do think actually that the amendments to the BBBEE codes are much more likely to impact directly on what employers do, because there's a greater carrot. They want business, so they've got to have the levels from the codes, and therefore they're going to try harder to reach their targets. But if you look at the targets which actually fit in those codes, our calculations are that they're physically impossible to reach within the time period stated. And on the next slide, I'll talk about the consequences of that. Consequence management, that's our fancy term for fitting the consequences to the action. And we believe that what should be done is that employers should be categorized into those which are making good progress, those which are beginning to make progress, and those which yet have to demonstrate compliance. And those three groups should be dealt with quite differently. Clearly, you need to differentiate by size as well, even where they're making good progress. But we need to stop recognising good progress. We need to stop publishing case studies, and we need to encourage research on what it is that has made those companies able to make that good progress. We could maybe do something like awarding extra points, and also it should be a low priority for BG reviews. In the 2004-2005 Employment Equity Commission report, it was actually announced that there would be awards. We have heard nothing since. And until you start doing that sort of thing and recognising people are doing the right thing, then it's going to be very difficult for other employers to get encouragement, to get guidance, and to be able to learn from them. Some companies where they're beginning to make progress, yes, we believe we should be keeping up the pressure. The Department of Labour should be able to make expert advice available to those companies, and yes, they could be, they should be subject to DG review. And compliance orders clearly are the way to go for those who need to demonstrate compliance. If you put more pressure on employers who are making good progress at this point, you will actually further escalate the management salary spiral and increase the wage gap, which everybody worries about quite rightly at the moment. We have research which we quoted in our position paper to show that to some extent the high level of management salaries has been propagated by a salary spiral starting from competition between employers for the scarce black talent available. And we know that you recruit somebody at a certain level, they're earning more than somebody else, you have to increase everybody else's salary to keep up, and this just keeps going. So more pressure in the wrong place, you're going to have that unintended consequence. If we move on to our argument about substantive compliance, in our view, the amendment to Section 42, which takes away the list of criteria by which you can assess whether an employer is making reasonable progress, will lead to some extremely unproductive discussions between employers and Department of Labour inspectors, because the only guidance is to say reasonable, which is really a matter of fodder for heated arguments. And the escalation of that argument is going to go straight to the Labour Court in terms of the Section 36 Amendment. I've got friends who are Labour lawyers, and they're rubbing their hands and waiting for this, because they're going to make a lot of money out of it. They could overload the Labour Court and get in the way of more important cases. So we believe that this combination of taking away the Section 42 criteria together with the Section 36 Amendment will have consequences which are not desirable. We think it's much better to set up clearly what substantive progress is going to make, substantive progress is going to look like, so that employers can actually self-regulate. They can look at that list and to say, are we doing well, are we not doing well? Our last point is that we think, this looks very self-interested, but we do believe that this is a constructive suggestion. Implementing employment equity in the workplace is a skills function. It's complex, as I said earlier, and we believe that you have to be properly qualified to do it. Standing up to management who is entrenched in old ways is not an easy thing to do. You need to have substantial backing, you need to be confident in your profession, and we believe therefore that the right people to make a contribution in this area are qualified HR professionals. Our HR professionals sign a code of conduct and commit themselves to issues such as promoting employment equity and transformation. So we're proposing that we introduce a requirement in regulation somewhere that all employment equity plans and reports should be signed by a properly registered HR professional. We think that that can contribute towards employers making some progress in these areas. And that concludes our presentation. We took a lot of effort into preparing the detailed position paper. We consulted quite heavily amongst our members, and the feeling is that we have made a balanced contribution to the debate, and we do encourage people to read it through. As I said, we need a lot more research in this area before we can start a well-founded way forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you very much for the submission. I would like to invite members of Parliament for questions, observations, answers, solutions. Okay. Honorable Master Mule, Honorable Mutau, and then Honorable Makwela Mashele.
Thank you. Dr. Ayula, you would remember. I'm not sure whether it's a slip of the tongue or you did it deliberately or intentionally. I thought there is a sufficient consensus in terms of our culture persuasion as a country starting from 90 until now. That person, I don't think is the chairman, it's the chairperson. And I don't know how you define PP. But I thought it's a sufficient consensus in terms of equity. It's supposed to be the chairperson of the chairman. Yeah, there is, on your last page, I'm very much interested as to hear from your views and opinion as to when you talk of HR professional, registered one, in terms of qualifications, at what level are you talking about here? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Mutau.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple of comments first and then a couple of questions. The remark about self-interest, that's not self-interest is probably the best motivator for anybody to do anything correctly, so keep acting the way that. With regard to the EE plans, yes, I can see for efficiency and understanding, you know, the professional, HR professional people. I presume, actually, coming out of business, that most of the big companies have professionals in that area. They do those plans, they send them all the CEOs. What would the smaller companies do, you know, those who can't afford this kind of expense? With regard to the other issue you raised, did I get you wrong? I got the impression that you were suggesting that the current EEA is fine, and that some of the amendments being proposed here could actually undermine the act itself in terms of efficiency and efficacy.
I would like to hear, you know, an example of one of those amendments that could probably be that. The other impression I've got was that, yes, the Act is fine, but to use your other expression, looks like we have weak management and enforcement of for compliance. That would imply that if we did those two things correctly, then we did not have to tinker too much with the Act itself, as it says.
Okay, thank you. In fact, we expect that the entire submission is based on self-interest. Honorable Mr. Mashele.
Thanks, Chairperson. In your presentation, you mentioned that you argue that the current employment equity report is questionable in such a way that you say, you put forward an argument that says you got a different from a different opinion to what the current report gives. And then you further go on and talk about getting a body such as FSA to put forward in a proper equity report, because I get a sense that you are questioning the credibility or the authenticity of the report, the current report that we are basing our work on, that we would be looking into in terms of compliance and the position of equity in the country. So I want to know, because you are talking about paper that you have put forward and that you have done, I want to understand the methodology that you've used, and also those that put together the employment equity can also stand on the other side and want to look at your report and look at the credibility and the authenticity of the sources of information that you got from. Because, I mean, getting information and them also putting together information, one can stand on the other side and say, well, the tools that you've used to derive this information is also questionable. So as a very learned person, can you at least enlighten me, give us the wisdom of how about you draw your analysis, and how did you go to a point of questioning the employment equity reports as presented to us, or as we have from the department?
Okay. Any other questions? Are we happy? Okay. All right. Just one or two questions and observations on my part. I think the assertion which I think you're making in the submission, that in order for us to attain employment equity, we will have to grow the economy. I think there's something of that sort. And then, of course, I think you made mention of the role of higher education, further education, and the need for more professionals to join the labor market. Otherwise, the picture has not really been changing. But I think that's the whole notion of growing the economy has been used in many instances to try and avoid changes, that for us to to transform the workplace, to transform management and all of that, we've got to grow the cake first. The cake as is not enough. We've got to grow that cake first before we can allocate everybody else. So I think that we've got to be careful how we use that notion of growing the economy first before we basically can share it, and that the law should apply whether the cake grows or not, in order for us to really get into the, to get employment equity. Now, then the question is, okay, my questions are as follows. One, you speak about self-regulation, that if the department put in place certain conditions, we can allow for self-regulation. And in an ideal situation. We would all want to have a situation where everyone self-regulates, says this is the law and let's follow the law to the letter. But unfortunately, we have been preoccupied with arguing for budget increases for the Department of Labor so that we have more labor inspectors. And I think more because there has not been compliance. So in your view, is it because and I think even with this current proposals, which are meant to strengthen compliance, which we have already had as the committee, and we'll hear more about the opposition to the new proposals by business in particular, in terms of the penalties we paid and all of that. Is it because the laws are too harsh? Is it because the punishment is too much? Or is it, are there other motives why people don't comply? Are there too many regulations that needs to be complied with? And if that's the case, what is it that needs to be done? Then the final question links to what Honorable Makubele Mashele raised on the statistics from the Commission for Employment Equity. Whether are you referring to the broader function of the Commission or specifically on the question of statistics? That is the information gathered to monitor whether there is transformation in terms of employment equity. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I can group them a little bit. Let's talk about statistics. My comments about statistics, I have used the figures in the Employment Equity Commission's report. So we don't have a different source of, we have not surveyed companies and got different figures. I'm purely using the figures that they got in that report. So the criticisms around that are partly, yes, we need to get more people reporting, and I think we all agree on that. That's not the issue. But our concern is that the comments which are made sort of underneath the tables in the report don't seem to have really thought about the figures in the report, what they're actually showing. So the comments don't seem to mirror the report, because if we take exactly the same figures, we can draw different conclusions. So we think that's a bit worrying. So we need to... So what I referred to in the paper, I've actually taken, I've showed the figures in the report, and I've showed our interpretation of exactly the same figures. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but if you look at the levels of representativity at professional level, you're probably finding that previously disadvantaged groups are creeping up to, let's say, 30%, something like that. And it might have been 20% before. So the Commission says that's good progress, which in a way it is, but if you look at the recruitment into that level, you're still seeing previous disadvantages and minorities, and therefore, logically, you cannot expect to have a big change in management levels if your pool, which comes from your profession level, is not transforming at that level. So that's our argument around that. Have I answered your question, Chairperson, about statistics? Are you okay with that? All right. The issue about economic growth and employment equity, we are certainly not saying that you should use the lack of economic growth as an excuse. We're saying probably when the law was first put in place, there were hopes of growth, and therefore there was less attention given to development actions for the future, because it was thought that economic growth would sort of catch up or would allow for more natural evolution of previously disadvantaged people into management. That has not been able to happen. But we also do know that we've got this really bad skill shortage. So our argument really is that the employers have got to get a lot more clever about developing pipelines of talent, of looking for talent, and of developing talent. So certainly it's not an excuse. It is probably a contributing factor to slower progress over the last 18 years than we would have liked, but it's not going to take us forward. We can't go on arguing that. So we might have to get rid of this argument. Self-regulation. I'm not saying that we should leave people to self-regulate, but I am saying that you combine compliance pressure with the ability of with clarity of objectives in the law. And therefore, if I'm an HR manager and I've got a set of criteria, I've got something to work towards. If I've simply got a thing saying, reasonable progress, and my only future is to go and argue that with the Department of Labour and the Labour Court, that's not quite a motivating. So I'd rather have a set of criteria by which I know that I'm making good progress. So that's our argument around it. The lack of progress is due to the laws being too harsh or too complicated. We believe that a well-qualified HR professional can interpret the laws and put in place perfectly good practical measures given the support of management to make some progress. So we don't think that the current law is too harsh. We are not opposed to the implementation of the fines and penalties. So yes, they're harsh, but if you can't be bothered to comply with the law, then that's the consequence of your own decision. As far as small business goes, there is a large industry of consultants at reasonable prices who do this sort of work for small companies. We don't think that's necessarily the best way to go. It would be much better to be able to empower companies to do it themselves. It's actually not all that complicated. We have actually got projects in place. We launched it earlier this year, where we're taking new HR graduates and supervision, equipping them to go into small companies and make them compliant by doing their employment equity plans, by doing their workplace skills plans, that sort of thing. So we're trying to be constructive about it. I don't think the law gets in the way of it. I think it's fairly clear at the moment. There was a comment about the combination of weak management and weak compliance. Yes, we think that there are deficiencies in management commitment to employment equity, and we do think that somehow the Department of Labour needs to get more clever about finding employers who are not compliant. I'm working on that. Someone asked about which amendments we think undermine the existing Act. We're really concentrating on that section 42, I think it is, where you take out the list of indicators of substantive compliance. And also a preference for engagement around that issue outside the Labour Court procedures. So more scope. So under the existing Act, you've got your compliance order, you can object, you can have a whole discussion around it, and only then do you go to the Labour Court. So we would say that putting matters straight into the Labour Court is maybe a little bit undesirable. What is a registered HR professional? Thank you for the question. I could do a whole version, but that's not the point. We register people at different levels. So we take people with a one-year certificate, a two-year certificate, a two-year diploma or a degree. They have to have experience. They have to go through a candidateship program. And then they are registered. We, as a professional body, we have to have membership standards. That's one of the requirements of ACWA to register as a professional body. So people can't be registered unless they meet certain criteria and have demonstrated a certain degree of competence. Clearly, we have still scope to go and ensure more competence amongst our registered practitioners, and we have big projects in place to do that right now. I hope I have answered your question.
Okay, thank you. We can allow one more follow-up question. Honorable Master Rumole.
Thanks. You answered my question, but I still need to get clarity as to
Do you, as a professional body, if you see a potential in someone, you have programs to upgrade? One, that's one. Number two, sorry about that. What would your opinion be, the difference between the definition of a worker and employee? If you have an opinion about that, because I saw here something to the effect that something is not clear about the definition of a worker. What's the difference between a worker and employee in terms of fire? Thank you.
Are you pointing up to a specific section in the presentation?
It's actually in the commission thank you. Take your last point. The Employment Services Bill refers to workers. So it says Section 5 talks about services and must include advising workers on access to education and training. And we've said in our submission that this section seems to be poorly worded, as it would on current drafting exclude work seekers from such advice, and that in fact no definition in the bill of what a worker is. In our terminology, we normally talk about employees. When you ask about upgrading somebody with potential, are you talking about within the HR profession or? Okay. Within the profession, very much so. We have extensive programs to help upgrade. My friend on Cape Peninsula University Technology has how many part-time students in HR? You know, lots and lots. So there are extensive opportunities for people to improve their knowledge and work, go up the career ladder in HR. It's one of the more open professions. You frequently get people who come from administration positions and they can end up as an HR director as long as they've got properly qualified along the way.
Okay, thank you very much for the submission. That's all. Okay, thanks. We'll have a short break. And then we should be back here at 11:05. We'll be resuming with the presentation of Dr. Mela. Thank you. She's right there in the back. Thank you and welcome back. We are going to be assuming a presentation which has been circulated and the full submission is also in the package, but there's a presentation which has been circulated from the Health Professional Council of South Africa, delegation led by Dr. Peggy Mbele. We will involve the other organizations, give you 20 minutes to the presentation, and then we will then have interaction. Sure.
Honorable Jefferson and honorable members of the portfolio committee and the colleagues at large. We come from the Health Professions Council. We just have also comments to make on the Employment Equity Amendment Bill. The delegation from the Health Professions Council is made up of Advocate Ntwane Matshidi, who is the legal advisor at the HSSA, Dr. Ndega Mloyi, who is the chairperson of the Psychometrics Committee at the HSSA, Professor Toleni Sodi, who is the chairperson of the Professional Board for Psychology and the Vice President of the Health Professions Council. And I am Peggy Mbele, I'm the General Manager of Professional Boards at the HPCSA. Honorable Chairperson, Professor Sodi is going to make the presentation of the HPCSA.
Thank you, Dr. Mbele, and thank you very much to the honorable members of the portfolio committee on labor, and a special word of appreciation to the chair. the Portfolio Committee, Mr. Malamela. The presentation is going to talk to essentially what the mandate of the Health Professions Council is and what the Professional Board of Psychology does, and of course our brief comment in terms of the proposed amendment. I'm struggling with technology. I hope the device struggle will help me with the technology as we move on. The mandate of the Health Professions Council, HPCSA was established in terms of the Health Professions Act 56 of 1974. And the key mandate of the HPCSA is to protect the public and to guide the health professions. Some of the key objects and functions of HPCSA are to serve and protect the public in matters involving the rendering of health services by persons practicing a health profession. And that is in section 3J of the Act. And another object is to uphold and maintain professional and ethical standards within the health professions. Now, the Professional Board for Psychology, which is the board that is entrusted with issues of psychometric testing, is one of the 12 professional boards constituting the Health Professions Council of South Africa, and this was established in terms of the Health Professions Act. And like all the other professional boards, the Professional Board for Psychology is mandated, among others, to maintain and enhance the dignity of the relevant health profession and the integrity of the persons practicing such profession, and also to guide the relevant health profession or professions and to protect the public. So that's essentially in broad terms what the 12 professional boards do in terms of the acts and as mandated by the health profession. Like all the other boards, we derive our mandate from the Health Professions Act, and I want to zoom in specifically on the scope of the profession of psychology, which was promulgated in 2008. And in terms of the Act, the following are some of the acts that are deemed to be falling within the scope of the profession of psychology. The evaluation of behavior or mental processes or personality adjustments or adjustments of individuals or of groups of persons through the use or interpretation of any psychological test, questionnaire, instrument, apparatus, device or similar method for the determination of intellectual abilities, aptitude, interest, personality makeup or personality functioning, and the diagnosis or measurement of personality and emotional functions, neuropsychological disorders, and mental functioning deficiencies according to a recognized scientific system for the classification of mental deficiencies. And that's in Section A of the Act. And another one is one of those functions is the evaluation of emotional, behavioral, and cognitive processes, adjustment of personality of individuals or groups of persons by the usage and interpretation of psychological questionnaires, tests, projections, or other techniques or any apparatus, whether of South African origin or imported, for the determination of intellectual abilities, aptitude, personality makeup, personality functioning, psychophysiological functioning, or psychopathology. And another important function here in terms of what the Professional Board for Psychology is supposed to do is the exercising of control over prescribed psychological questionnaires or tests. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry about that. The exercising of control over prescribed psychological questionnaires or tests or prescribed techniques, apparatus or instruments for the determination of intellectual abilities, aptitude, personality makeup, personality function, psychophysiological functioning, or psychopathology. The development of a control over the development of psychological questionnaires, tests, techniques, apparatus, or instruments for the determination of intellectual abilities, aptitude, personality makeup, personality functioning, and for psychopathology. Now, in terms of psychometric testing in our country, I just want to give a brief background and history there. Historically, the field of psychological testing in South Africa developed and was practiced in an environment that was characterized by an unequal distribution of resources based on racial categories, as we know them in the past. Consequently, psychological testing was used as a tool to perpetuate the colonial and apartheid myths of white supremacy and black inferiority. And the advent of a democratic dispensation saw the transformation of psychology to a profession that started to be responsive to the socio-cultural needs of the South African people. Now, why do we need to regulate psychological testing in South Africa? Looking at the mandate of the Professional Board for Psychology regarding the scope of the profession of psychology, it is therefore evident that the field of psychometric testing should be controlled and regulated by the Health Professions Council of South Africa. The other reason why there is a need for this, as you have seen in terms of the history of psychological testing in South Africa, demonstrates that these instruments are powerful tools that can be used to decide the fate and destiny of individuals and communities. And such decisions impact on the future of people in terms of schools they can attend, opportunities they can be exposed to, etc. It is therefore important to ensure that such measures are appropriately regulated. Another reason we're mentioning here why there is a need to regulate is there are many psychological tests that are currently flooding the market. In some cases, access to these instruments is unlimited, for example, through the internet. The use of these instruments will thus need to be controlled to ensure that the public is not exposed to activities that can harm them. Now, in terms of the proposed amendment, we broadly concur with what is proposed. We don't really have a problem with what is there before us. And maybe just what we want to suggest, just a slight alteration in terms of subsection D, where we say psychometric testing and other similar assessments of an employee are prohibited unless the test or assessment being used has been certified by the Health Professions Council of South Africa, established under the Health Professions Act 56 of 1974, or any other body appointed or delegated by the Health Professions Council of South Africa to certify such tests or assessment. So the section that is underlined is basically where we're proposing a little change or adjustment to the proposed amendment. Otherwise, that's essentially what we have, and thank you very much.
Okay. There we have it. Thank you very much for that submission. Essentially, you can declare people as psychologically unfit, and you want to be regulated from abusing that power. Okay. Are there any questions? Honorable Nyakemba, Honorable Master Rumule, and maybe Honorable William Scott. Yes, psychologically not in the... Okay.
That is innate testing. And obviously, that the bodies that have performed that. No, thank you very much. Thanks. Psychometric testing. vis-a-vis psychological testing. I think that's the main thrust of your presentation. Am I correct if your presentation suggests that in the amendments of the Employment Equity Guidelines Act, any matter that relates to psychological testing, it must be covered in terms of introducing or professional body that it must be the one that does that. I see they are saying this, but they will reply as to whether I am correct. And then linked to that, the slides, the last one, before thank you, there's a reference to D. In your proposed amendments, I think this G, in my thinking, should be linked to a particular proposed amendment in the case that is in front of us. If yes, that G falls in which section that is proposed to be amended in the case. I just want that clarity to share. I think if that can be clarified, I might have follow-up questions or not. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Master Roble.
Thanks. What actually comes to my mind here is I just need clarity if allowed. About profession. But how would you, where would you locate indigenous health practitioners? What would you call it traditional? In Canada, in Australia, the preferred way is indigenous. How do you locate that?
Okay, are those all the questions? Thank you.
If I could go to the first two questions, starting with the concepts, psychometric testing, psychological testing, even throwing another one, psychological assessment. Essentially, broadly, we're talking about the same thing, but there will always be differences in terms of nuances as you move into the patient, but broadly, we're talking about psychological testing. Now, in terms of the issue relating to whether or not it should be this body that controls that, yes, indeed. In fact, if you look at the Health Professions Act, specifically the regulations that I referred to earlier, regulations pertaining to the scope of the profession of psychology, it does specifically state that these are psychological acts. Therefore, in terms of the acts, all psychological acts, including issues of exercising control over the development and classification of tests and so on, those should be the province of the Health Professions Council, and in particular the Professional Board of Psychology, which is one of the constituent structures of the Health Professions Council. So, yes, in fact, that is precisely what it is. It means all these tests or instruments that should be used, as long as they tap into psychological activities or psychological makeup, whether intellectual, personality, or whatever, this should be regulated and controlled by the Health Professions Council in terms of the Act. Now, regarding the which specific section we are proposing that should be amended, if you look at the proposed amendment, in its current form, it says section 4, subsection D, says, has been certified by the Health Professions Council of South Africa established by Section 2 of the Health Professions Act, or any other body which may be authorized by law to certify those tests or assessments. So that is what is in the proposed amendment as reflected here. We're saying, just to modify it a little bit, where it says, or any other body which may be authorized by law, we say, or any other body appointed or delegated by the Health Professions Council to certify such tests or assessments. So essentially, is probably the same, just one minor adjustment, just to ensure that even in the future, if there has to be any body that regulates this, it should always be, in terms of the act that regulates health professions, it should always be something that has been delegated or appointed by the Health Professions Council of South Africa. I take it that answers the first two questions. I've left the last question to address last, because I think that's one of the most interesting issues and something incidentally that is close to my heart in terms of my own research interest and my focus in academia. The issue of indigenous healers, or traditional healers, or Inaka, as we obviously know them in our African languages, is a very interesting point, because more often some of us would argue that in fact the work that psychologists are doing and the work that traditional healers are doing, to a large extent, two sides of the same coin. The difference, of course, is us as psychologists, we are a profession that is regulated in terms of the Health Professions Act, and they are not regulated by the same act as we are. But we're also aware that there is an act that has been passed by the same parliament, the Traditional Health Practitioners Act, which seeks to regulate the activities of the traditional healers. And I suppose some of their activities would then be such that whatever they would be doing on their part and whatever we'll be doing, now that there is a structure that is supposed to be there to regulate them, there will then be provision for us to easily communicate with our colleagues, the traditional healers, because now there is a mechanism that would have been put in place to deal with those. I know there are some challenges in terms of implementing that act, but otherwise we are aware of the existence of that act. Thank you.
Yes, would allow that. Honorable Kemba and then Honorable Williams.
Thank you, Jefferson. It might be ignorance on my part. Because when I look at what you are proposing, broadly is covered with what is in the amendment. Which part in the amendment, as it is that you are not satisfied with? Because for me, without you raising that, while you're making this presentation in order, I've got a public hearing where we as the Portfolio Committee now will be applying our minds in terms of how do you process the amendments. So we must take into account submissions that are made. Now, really, I'm not clear exactly what is it, because this amendment is making a reference to the Health Professions Council, in fact, to the same act that you are trying to. And it went further to say any other law. Obviously, there can be no institution that is used unless it is under law. Now, if you can be a little bit specific on that
lack of deficit, that is the issue with you, as the amendment stands. Thank you, sir.
Shepherds, my follow-up, my question is very similar to the last one. Fundamentally, the amendment talks to any other body which may be authorized by law to do that, whereas your proposal is any other body appointed by your organization. So fundamentally, if your proposal becomes the law, then you'll be the only body that can appoint those people. So I'd like to know which bodies exist at the moment that can do the same job as you with regard to this section. In other words, and are there any bodies existing at the moment under law that can that are authorized to do this assessment? Thank you.
Okay, can I respond? Thanks. Well, I take it that the two questions are essentially the same. Is there don't want to go there. Yes. Well, as I did point out earlier, and maybe Dr. Mulroy will come in at some point here, so just comment as well. We essentially don't have a problem with the proposed amendment as it stands. That is in the bill. Perhaps what we have as an adjustment just maybe reflects our anxieties around the act and what may ultimately happen, I mean, if you say, or any other body. And that is why we just felt that it would be important if that is very explicit, to say, if we're saying any other body that is recognized by law, so that body, which is the any other, should have been delegated or appointed by the Health Professions Council. So that's just the little nuance in terms of this. Otherwise, broadly, it is still going to talk to or any other body, but maybe just in terms of how we have put it there. And so we believe that is the little nuance that is contained in terms of the proposal that we are making. But otherwise, generally, we are not particularly distressed by the amendment as we see it.
Thank you, Chair. Currently, there is no other body that classifies or certifies psychological tests. So it's only the HPCAC and the Professional Board for Psychology.
Clear. Okay. Thank you very much for the submission. And I'm sure it will help us greatly in our deliberations. Thank you. And with that, we'll be going into our next submission. Thank you for your comments. And I'd like to invite the Cape Chamber of Commerce, Mr. Michael Bagrain. I hope I'm pronouncing that properly. Bagrain. Bagrain. Oh, okay. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Order. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bagrain. We will be giving you 2 minutes for presentation, and then we will interact with your presentation thereafter. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. I have made a submission, and I will basically read from it, but I'm happy to take any questions if any follow. And I'm Michael Bagram, I'm the chair of the Human Resource Portfolio, and we do want to comment on the amendment to Equity and Employment Services Bill. The Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry is the largest chamber of commerce and industry in Africa. The Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry services businesses throughout the Cape.
My apologies, can we just confirm if every member of parliament has the same issue?
I'm sorry, it came through on my letterhead, but it's not Cape Chamber letterhead, it's my personal letterhead.
That's a problem.
I'll pay you for the advertising.
Okay, thank you. You can go ahead.
Can I go ahead? The Cape Chamber is a member of BUSA, Business Unity South Africa, and interacts regularly with government on all tiers. I'm not sure if you've had the BUSA submissions yet, Mr. Chairman, but we do identify with the BUSA submissions, which are probably more in-depth submissions than ours. The majority of membership of the Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry is small business, i.e. businesses less than 50 employees, and a large proportion of the membership is made up of emerging business. It must be remembered, Mr. Chairman, that often when you see chambers of commerce, one thinks of old, white, large business. And this is not the truth, and it's certainly not made up of that at all. The Cape Chamber thanks you, Mr. Chairman, to give us the opportunity to address the portfolio committee, and is particularly concerned about various aspects of the amendment bills. We don't want to enter into an intellectual discussion, and we're certainly not looking to attack certain provisions right here and now. I don't have the time to do that. The only aspects which the Cape Chamber would like to give input on, but for the sake of brevity, the Chamber will comment on some of the small issues. As I said, Mr. Chairman, we do align ourselves behind BUSA, and you will hear the BUSA submissions in early course. The enormous work that has been put into the NEDLAC process over the past 2 years on these amendments needs to be recognized and applauded. However, the NEDLAC process has been to a large degree overridden by some of the very surprising and shocking recommendations coming out of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, despite agreements being reached in NEDLAC. Mr. Chairman, I do want to...
Don't worry if you see the chairperson leaving, you can continue, but can you repeat this part?
Thank you. I will, and I'll repeat it verbatim. The enormous work that has been put into the NEDLAC process over the past 2 years on these amendments needs to be recognized and applauded. However, the NEDLAC process has been to a large degree overridden by some of the very surprising and shocking recommendations coming out of the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee, despite agreements having been reached at NEDLAC. I want to pause over there, you, Mr. Chair. I want to pause in the sense that there's a strong feeling in the business community that NEDLAC has become a toy telephone, that you have a place to talk, and yet whatever agreements that are struck at NEDLAC then come through to these portfolio committees and then are overridden. And to a large degree, many people feel despondent when they come and sit here and they feel that they've spent 2 years coming to compromise. They feel very despondent coming out of NEDLAC. And it needs to be said that if NEDLAC is not going to be recognized as the primary negotiating chamber, then the parties ought to know that beforehand. We need to know what value is NEDLAC. Well, what comes out of NEDLAC? Is there any value at all, or is it just a talk show? And this commentary holds good for all the suggested amendments to the Labour Relations Act, Basic Conditions of Employment Act, and the two bills before us today. Firstly, and I know this is an old gory bugbear, a regulatory impact assessment was conducted at the behest of the Department of Labour. And now that the bills are finalised and the wording appears to be almost set, it is suggested that it would be wise to take the largely challenged amendments back to a regulatory impact assessment again. In other words, we're now at the death of the wording. We should go back to that regulatory assessment and have it properly assessed as to what this is going to mean to job creation. My strong belief is that much of this is going to retard job creation, and I'll explain just now. The parties place a great merit, all the parties always place a great merit on the regulatory assessments, and no harm can come from another investigation, a proper investigation to be done now whilst we've got the final wording, or we're almost at the final wording. So I would strongly suggest, and the Chamber has suggested, that we go through that assessment once more, a final assessment. The first one was done on very different wording. It is wholly endorsed that matters of discrimination at the workplace should be able to be referred to the CCMA for arbitration. Now, I need to pause there, Mr. Chair, in the sense that I spend a lot of my time and my professional life at arbitrations, at the CCMA, and whenever there's a issue that is raised with regard to discrimination, that issue takes that individual at least 3 or 4 years to get resolved through the labour courts, and I think this is a good move to allow the CCMA, the Commission for Conciliation, Mediation and Arbitration, to actually have a look at this and to then rule on it. That being said, the CCMA awards should have limitations as per to Section 48. One doesn't want awards sounding in millions of rands, and especially at the workplace. The entire proposal on compliance and enforcement appears to be largely problematic and will lead to an enormous time wastage, legal costs, and frustration. And let me explain. We've just heard Mr. Kepeldas from the Department of Labor. I don't see Mr. Kepeldas here, but we've heard him telling South Africa that compliance is a problem, that we have laws and that we have very few inspectors, and compliance is a real problem. And I tend to agree with him. I don't normally agree with Mr. Kepeldas, but in this particular instance, I would certainly agree with him, and the Chamber feels very strongly that enforcement and compliance, where we stand right now, the laws that we have, the labour laws that we have very little enforcement and compliance. It doesn't really help us to start correcting laws, to start amending laws, when in fact we're not implementing the laws in the first place. We're not putting them into place at all. It appears that our government wants to facilitate a speedy and sure way of enforcing compliance orders, which is fine. We certainly want to have a speedy and sure way of reporting it. The answer the government seems to have come up with is that the business community should not object and appeal the compliance orders. Now, when you've got a compliance order from the Department of Labor and you don't have an objection process or an appeal process for that compliance order, what will the business community do? What do you think they will do? They will then go to the Labor Court, and that will retard the process by another 2 years at least, instead of being hanged through the appeal process, which is quick. So it is silly. It's a silly reaction to say that we must get rid of the appeal and objections, because it's just not going to work. The argument appears to be that these objections and appeals are time-consuming and retard process. Well, they might be, but they retard the process only for a few weeks, as opposed to going to the Labour Court, which will retard the process for years. This backlash needs to be considered. The reality of the situation is that the businesses will react by referring the matters to the Labour Court, so we're going to get bogged down in courts. The Labour Court takes anything up to 1 or 2 years to have the matters heard. This will create a much greater problem than the one that we already have. We're faced with a problem where people do object to compliance orders and they do appeal them, but that's short compared to what it will be, and one needs to have a look at the assessment of that and to see what it means. The problem, obviously, can be cured by rather small money, on rather having more inspectors. The Department of Labour needs a greater inspectorate, better trained inspectors and better paid inspectors, and I know this is a swear word, but the inspectorate of the Department of Labour at the moment, I think, is under-resourced wholly. The inspectorate are completely under-resourced, underpaid and under-trained. And I think we should be spending more time, money and effort on getting the inspectorate at the Department of Labour properly resourced. We need to ensure that the laws that we do have are properly enforced before we start looking at something that's something new and tangled. There are hundreds of examples, I can go through many of them, where legislation is good, but the enforcement is null. We have wonderful laws in place at the moment. Our labour laws are probably the best in the world as we're facing now. It ain't broke, I'm not sure why we're trying to fix it. This debate should take place before any amendments are put into force. The law cannot cure lack of enforcement. Only government can, only departments can. The law is not going to give a better enforcement. And it doesn't matter if we try and put together a Rolls Royce or a Mercedes Benz as opposed to a Volkswagen, it doesn't mean that it's going to drive better if we don't have a driver. We need to ensure that we have enforcement. It is trite to say that our system of labor relations is based in consultation and negotiation. Unlike our past, the labor community don't have to resort to court action immediately. Now, this is, South Africa has become famous in the world for this. If we go out and we negotiate, we consult, we talk before we get to court action. And what these amendments are trying to do are trying to force us into the courts, which I think is silly in its essence. The suggested amendments will change the very nature of the system and force the parties to resort to a fight as opposed to a discussion. And I think it's the wrong reaction altogether. I'm not going to take you through section by section, but the Portfolio Committee will understand that each time you take away the ability to appeal or the ability to object, then you're forcing people into court. Excuse me. It's amazing to see the amendments to section 20 bracket 7 and section 21 bracket 6. These amendments force the parties to go directly to the Labour Court without any discussion whatsoever. Now that goes against the very essence, the golden thread that runs through our labour law. There is a golden thread, and we must value that gold. And that is, we've moved away from the old government, where we're now in a situation where we can talk, we can negotiate, we can consult. And this is forcing you right back into those old days. This will be costly in the sense that the labour costs will have to be extended tenfold and will be staffed at much greater levels. Wouldn't it rather be more efficient, less costly and user-friendly to expand the workforce at an inspectorate level rather than a judge level? And I think we've moved into that era. We're 20 years down the line with our new Labour Relations Act. We, as a business community, have bought in very strongly to the Labour Relations Act, and negotiation becomes an order of the day as opposed to litigation. I, as a lawyer, favour the litigation. If these amendments go through as they stand, it would be fantastic for me. I'll have a lot more work, I can employ a lot more lawyers, but I don't think that's what the committee's looking for. They're not looking to make lawyers busy. As it can be seen that many of these amendments will put enormous pressure on the adjudication process as opposed to the enforcement process. Even the heavily overburdened CCMA will probably find its caseload doubled when all these amendments are passed. I don't know if you've seen the recent results, the statistics coming out from Nerini Khan recently 2 months ago at the CCMA as to how the system is burdened. Already the system is overburdened. If you pass these as they stand right now, I reckon the system will probably double. It must be said that the CCMA in its current form has been largely effective and has certainly enhanced the quality of life at the workplace. So one needs to propose that the CCMA needs an applaud at this point. They certainly do, because they have enhanced the quality of the workforce. But with these enormous burdens that you are now going to be placing on the shoulders of the CCMA commissioners, one can only envisage chaos. It'll be an interesting chaos, and obviously the lawyers will be happy. With regard to the employment services bill, it is also suggested that many of these amendments, although idealistic, will probably never be able to be properly enforced. So you can't enforce what we've already got, are you making it a lot more onerous and burdensome? Many of the suggested changes will place an enormous burden on the Department of Labor, whose budget at the moment is stretched to the limit. But it's notoriously sluggish when the department has to respond to the public and the business community. Unfortunately, the Department of Labor is overburdened to a large degree where we stand right now. And I think they can ill afford these extra burdens that are going to be placed upon them. It might be said to be correct to have an employment services board, but the functionality of same is seriously doubted. Many of the issues, such as the reporting on vacancies and the filling of positions, should be left to private enterprise and not placed on the shoulders of the government. One can't understand how government is even going to service us. I would like to be sitting here in 2 years' time, pass this law, and I'd like to be sitting here and find out how many placements are actually being done. I think it will become profitable. Many schemes, such as the training layoff scheme, are brilliant ideas. The training layoff scheme is a fantastic idea and was strongly supported by everyone. But they've not produced any results. I mean, the results have been minor, absolutely minor. when we were when we've gone into South Africa over the last 2 years, we've had massive retrenchments across the board. You name the industry, I can tell you how many retrenchments have been there. Unfortunately, the training layoff schemes have not helped us in any way. Despite the brilliance of the scheme, it has merely been seen as something on paper as opposed to something in reality. It's not been supported by the business community and it's not been supported by the trade union group at all. So there's got to be something wrong in practice. On paper, fantastic. But the trade unions have said no. I've tried it myself. I've approached trade unions from the consulted trade unions to the independents. And they've all told me to go away. Forget about it. The suggestion to be able to cancel the registration of a private employment agency is draconian and would effectively kill the industry which is dedicated to job placements when in fact we're anything up to 30% unemployment in this country. You're not going to destroy the companies that are desperately trying to place people. Many of the fines suggested are more and more draconian and would to a large degree appear to be trying to criminalise the labour law. Some of those fines are horrendous. And I think you shouldn't put minimum fines. What should be done is that each case should be tried on its merits. Look at the business, look at their turnover, look at the profits. Then fine them in accordance with that. Don't criminalise our labour law. It is important to understand that there's a negative perception in the business community. It's an incredibly negative perception that exists world over, and I'm not talking about just Africa. But unfortunately over here it's affecting us badly. Our Minister of Finance said at the last discussions that the business community are sitting on something like 15 billion rand, which they're not investing even in their own businesses. Why is that? Why are they not investing? Why have no one got faith to invest in their own businesses? Why are they going abroad to invest? And it's probably because they're getting the returns abroad. They're not getting the returns from their own businesses here. There's a problem. They're not using their own finances to grow their own businesses, which in turn would create jobs in this country. Why is it? And it's perception. A lot of it is perception. This negative perception is all pervasive and needs to be turned around as soon as possible. We need to be spending some time, energy and money convincing the business community that they need to invest in their own businesses in South Africa. They need to create jobs. There's a perception out there that it's a lot easier to get a divorce than to dismiss an employee. And that perception is growing with each amendment that gets pushed on us. The international business community see our system of hiring and firing as extremely negative. And even if in fact it's not negative, that is the perception that exists. And with each amendment, that perception grows. We must do more to change this viewpoint, Mr. Chairman. We need to consider the fact that we need to grow our economy, we need to grow jobs, and we need to look at ways and means of being that 30% unemployed bring them into the workplace. In essence, Mr. Chairman, what the Trade Chamber is saying is that before we start looking at the minutiae of amendments to any of the labour legislation, what we should do is get the labour legislation we have now, get it right, make sure it's properly implemented, and make sure it's enforced. I thank you for listening to me, and I'm happy to answer some questions.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you for the submission. I'll start with Honorable Masumule, Honorable Tau, Honorable Oshele, Honorable Williams, and Honorable Nekamba. Just all of you. Just I think for the record, with in relation to the section which has got nothing to do with this submission, which is on paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that NADLAC is a very important role player, and the parties of NADLAC, the efforts which they put into negotiating the labor relations and the labor laws in general, that those efforts are greatly appreciated, and that it has greatly helped the portfolio committee in our deliberations of the different laws which have been presented before us. But just to emphasize that Parliament is not a big rubber stamp for NADLAC. I think that it's important that we emphasize that in as much as the parties at NADLAC would reach an agreement, consensus, compromises, which we really appreciate, that we are going to continue to shock you, and we are going to continue to surprise you, because we are not a rubber stamp for Netherlands. We take all the submissions into consideration, and that's why even beyond the Netherlands process, we allow for submissions, even by the parties which are involved at NELEC. And many of the parties have come here having changed their minds based on the negotiations, and all of that. So I don't think that part about the portfolio committee having disregarded NELEC, I don't think that it belongs to this submission. That being said, let me allow, starting with Honorable Masaru Mule.
Thank you, Chair, thanks for the presentation. I hear probably Chair says is a legal minded person in the community. I hear Ms. Bagafogi say and everybody else. Employers will start off with the goal to sleep every day peacefully. The story goes. I hear so, unless you have a different opinion. My questions are two. One, can you be specific about the areas where you strongly feel Parliament is undermining legislative processes, specifically? Which areas? Which has to do with it? Secondly, what makes employers to observe laws of compliance? What makes it so difficult for them to comply? To make the laws and functioning is what? Specifically, what are we talking about here?
Okay, thank you, Honorable Tao.
Thank you, Chair. Observation from one of the points you made here about the law not being able to procure enforcement. I happen to share that view, that we need to be working much more diligently with the inspectorate and make sure that those who break the law are punished severely. So where is the failure? Where do you think is the failure?
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Makubela comes first before my share. Chairperson, although I'm partly covered, but I just feel, as the only role amongst the thorns, the people that need to hear my voice. I'm the only role amongst the thorns in the portfolio committee. But mine was just to emphasize the issue and put the difference between the two, the NEDLEC process, and us as members of Parliament, we are called honorable members and we are called lawmakers. We don't just come in and just put a rubber stamp and say approved, disapproved, by processes outside Parliament. We apply our own mind in the lawmaking process. And whatever comes out of our lawmaking process, it means we have applied our minds and we saw it fit to shape the laws of this country to the direction that we see fit as people who are entrusted to come into this institution and make law. So at times I would want to as yourself called Chamber of Business, to at times just respect that part, that we just don't come to Parliament and just think and just make laws without thinking we have applied our mind. If you have seen anything that is overturned from a process somewhere else, it means those members of Parliament sat there and they saw that this was fit for the law that we were amending or making.
Thank you very much. Son?
Honorable William. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yes, well, I just want to comment on the whole NEDLAC story. Generally speaking, when it comes to NEDLAC, and we receive the reports from in the processes, when NEDLAC does reach consensus, we normally do not mess with that at all, and we do understand that. But fundamentally, NEDLAC is just assists the law-making body, which is Parliament, that are elected. You see, on NEDLAC, don't get elected, you get appointed. So if you'd like to have Parliament appointed, you can see where there'll be a problem there. I just want to talk about compliance and enforcement. You went on about compliance and enforcement and what a burden it would be and how the department can't handle it. But fundamentally, you also said and you admitted that business, there's very little compliance when it comes to labour legislation with regard to business. So you admit that business is breaking South African law. And now you're saying, we break the law, but we're not happy with you trying to penalise us for breaking that law. So fundamentally, it's a bit dodgy, your argument. You want to continue breaking the law and have less penalties for doing that, and then you want to have less legislation enforcing you to comply, more opportunity to continue breaking the law while you're going through the appeals process that you want. So if you can just give me some clarity, what exactly is business asking for here? Would you like us to scrap labour law completely and, you know, be a country that doesn't have any labour law at all so you can make as much money as you like? Thank you.
Okay, Honourable Nyagemba.
Thank you very much, President. Let me welcome your submission. I think on the issue of neglect, much has been said. But just in addition, when you go to the Constitution of the Republic, there are three branches of the state. One is the legislature. That's us. Two is the executive. Three is the judiciary. So I heard you in your submission question what we do. So the point I'm making here is that we are doing what we do as mandated by the Constitution of the Republic. I just wanted to just raise that. I think on the issue of neglect, I think you are clear now. What is neglect? How does neglect? And for that matter, neglect account to this portfolio of it. That's neglect. It is an act. An act at neglect doesn't decide on anything. It reached consensus. And the same act that made the existence of NEDLAC, the Act of 1994, gave Parliament powers on top of that. And I think it has been explained to you, you will be living a better person now, understanding NEDLAC. I think the on the issue of the fines and the proposed eliminating some appeals in the process. Now, the question therefore that arises is, why fights? Why appeals? It is because there's non-compliance to an existing law. I think you want your presentation suggest to me that you want a situation where if you have not complied, then it must be business as usual. The process must be prolonged to such an extent that you continue with your non-compliance to whatever level. So I think that becomes the part that I want you to really say what is it that you want. You want us to make laws or not to make laws. You want us to allow you to continue non-compliance. Because the Employment Equity Act, the non-compliance in terms of the Employment Equity Act, in the main, I thought you would speak even on the reports
of the Employment Equity Commission. Because companies, businesses are given an opportunity in terms of the principal action to draw their plans. After they've done that, they don't comply with the same plans that they said at this particular period we will be at that level. Now, you want us as Parliament to say, no. Something has been tried to be done. I think you must assist us on that. With the RIA, you made reference to RIA. RIA was done immediately when the department put together the bill, in particular on the LRA amendments. And RIA was done. I'm not sure whether when you made mention of RIA, were you making reference to the amendments of the Labour Relations Act or the amendments on the Employment Equity Act. I think I would like you to clarify us on that. What is it that you want to ask exactly? The also made mention the Employment Services Bill, in particular the private employment agencies, deregistration, and all of those. But the only thing that you have mentioned as to in the Employment Services Bill, how does it suggest that there must be deregistration? I mean, you must think of that. It can't be a question to say deregister. Why there has to be deregistration? You don't speak to that. I thought you would raise that and say this is incorrect to deregister. So you were just saying that. The last point for me, sir, is you want us to employ more labor. In fact, the department to employ more labor inspectors. The question is for what? Because business is not complying. You want now the department to have many inspectors in order to change businesses who do not comply with the law of the land. I mean, I think I take that as a confession that business, as you represent here, the Western Cape Chamber of Business, they do not comply with labor legislation intentionally. So it's not a mistake. It's not because they don't have capacity. I take that as you telling Parliament. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, Honorable Marcello wants to have another point.
Okay, thanks, Chairperson. You know, the last arguments that you put forward were the issue of the lack of investment by business in the country, the millions or the billions that they are sitting on and not investing in the country. And, well, I just want to find out, enlighten us here, of the assumptions or the fact that you are putting is business, although they have money, not investing in the country, because we have rigid labor laws that do not foster or do not make the environment conducive for business to invest in the country.
Okay, I think that's enough for some time. I had my own questions, but
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I must admit that there's some trying questions, and I'm happy to answer them. I certainly don't agree basically with any of you, and let me explain why. I'm not going to be browbeaten by any stretch.
I must say that Honorable Motau actually said he agrees with you, so
I'm one of the
hope it doesn't include you.
Okay, let me start. First of all, to you, Mr. Chair, and I respect Ned Lack, I respect the processes. And I certainly respect, and for everyone that got upset about Parliament being a rubber stamp, I respect what Parliament has to do, and I certainly did not say it was a rubber stamp. However, and this needs to be said, and I'm maybe standing where fools never fear to tread. It needs to be said that if the country has set up a body such as NEDLAC, and the parties have come to an agreement after 2 years of discussion, if that's happened, it doesn't help then just to ignore it. And I'm not saying that Parliament ignores it, and I'm not saying that the Parliamentary Committee ignores it. I don't believe that they're giving it the true value of those discussions. The parties all gave and take. The trade union movement gave and take. They come to the parliamentary submissions, and then they decide, no, that that happened there, they're now not going to give and take. And I still feel very strongly that the parties of NEDLAC, after having given and taken so much, are feeling despondent. They do feel despondent. They come out of there, and I feel the business community feels that. They come out of there after negotiating for 2 years, they've given up what they feel they had to give up, they've negotiated where they can, and they come to a body such as this, and then they feel that parties then start again. Now, I understand what Parliament has to do. You have to make the best laws that you're able to make for the country, and that will take into account what comes out of the NEDLAC. And you're not bound by that, but I'm saying that it needs to be clearer. It needs to be clearer that it doesn't matter what happens at NEDLAC, we, at this body, we then make those decisions. And I don't think that's ever been fully clear to the parties at NEDLAC, that they feel that they've come out of the negotiations and it's been largely undermined. I know there was one of the questions saying, give me some examples, I will give that, so let me go through it. I'm not saying that Parliament's a rubber stamp, I never did say that, and I never will say that. I have great respect for Parliament, and that's why I'm sitting here. I'm sitting here because I would like to put my small voice, and I'm only a tiny little voice, I'm sitting down here in the corner of the country, and I'd like to put it into it, and I have great respect for it. The point was made, sir, that employers sleep peacefully. I'm not so sure that that's the truth of the matter. I'm not so sure that anyone sleeps peacefully in a country which has, I believe, closer to 40% unemployment. So I don't believe anyone's sleeping very peacefully, and I strongly believe that. But you're saying, be more specific, what is agreed at NEDLAC and then it comes and gets overturned? Well, for instance, it was not part of this debate over here, and I respect you, Mr. Chair, I could give you some specifics, such as the 6 months or the 3 months, and it's not this part of this debate, but I don't want to get into those sort of debates, and such as the balloting of the trade unions. Those things were proposed by the Department of Labour, not by business, not by the employers, and that then gets disagreed at this level. I don't want to get into that long debate. I was only given 20 minutes. I can get into that debate in due course if you need. You said, and a few speakers made the point, that if there's non-compliance, obviously the business community is admitting, they're confessing, they're doing all sort of things, but I think it needs to be said, and the Chamber of Commerce have been saying this for years. People, doesn't matter whether they're employers or employees, are dishonest. Some people are dishonest. Some people break the law. The employers who don't break the law feel bad and heartsore about this because they have to comply with the law. That means they've got to pay a minimum wage. I've used one example. We've just seen this up in KwaZulu-Natal in the clothing industry. The employers are saying, we have to pay the minimum wage, but the other employers who are not paying the minimum wage, please force the compliance. The business community is shouting this for years, so don't tell me this is a confession. This is it's a strong advice to Parliament saying, please employ people to comply with the law. So we need more inspectors, and we've been shouting this for years. There are people in the business community that are breaking the law, and the rest of the business community can't tolerate that. They certainly can't tolerate it. So it doesn't help saying, oh, well, you've confessed, so now you're all liars and thieves. That's not the truth of the matter. The truth of the matter is that the business community is saying that many employers do break the law, and the other employers are heartsore about this because they can't compete with them then. If an employer gets his goods in, stolen goods, to be able to sell to the public, he's got no overheads. Now, the man who buys the goods got a massive overhead. He's not unhappy with the man who steals the goods. Like, for instance, the man who doesn't pay the minimum wage. If that man doesn't pay the minimum wage, the business community close ranks against him. And we would like to see more inspectors, better qualified inspectors, better resourced inspectors, We want those people put out of business if they're breaking law, and we strongly believe that. So it doesn't help to say, well, that's compassion, so that's the end of the business community. If there was no business community, no one would be creating jobs. If there was no business community, no one would be paying tax. The business community needs to ensure that we do grow and that the jobs grow. So just to answer you on that particular issue with regard to compliance, yes, compliance is at an all-time low. And yes, business community are breaking the laws. And we need to make sure that they don't break the laws. Before the business community that is honest wants to conduct business in South Africa in the future. I hope that answers all the questions that you raised, sir, with regard to compliance. That we do need more compliance and we do need to ensure that we spend more money, more time and more effort. And I don't think I'm the lone voice for saying that the Department of Labour, I think, is under-resourced. I think that they're under-resourced, but I think they need a greater budget and we need to see it. And I think business community would support that wholeheartedly throughout. I understand, Mrs. Rose, that at the end of the day, that yes, Parliament has got its own mind, it always will have its own mind. All we can do as members of the public is to have a voice to try and convince you to listen to us and to hear us. That's all. You don't have to follow. Certainly you don't have to follow. That's not the argument. The argument here is, and that's the very nature of why I'm sitting here, is I'm trying to influence you in that little way. In that little way. That's all. I might be of no influence in that. So be it. I can't do any more than that other than to beg and plead. I understand that, Mr. Williams, that you said that my argument is spurious. Now, I don't follow you at all because your whole premise of the argument that I raised when your premise was one more inspector, so therefore you know you're breaking the law, so therefore what's this all about? Well, we want to have a business community that is compliant. That's all it's all about. Hear that. Hear that the business community is pleading with Parliament to say, we would like to be on a level playing field ourselves. For years we've heard that there's not a level playing field between the employer and employee. That we understand. And that we're trying to correct. But you also have to have a level playing field in businesses that comply and those that don't comply. And the only way you're going to get that playing field level is to make sure everyone complies. That's the only way we're going to get there. And it's a philosophical debate, but I think it's a debate in the labor law sphere that can be cured by more inspectors. I challenge you to bring more inspectors to come and sit here and tell you whether they've all got the proper training, whether they have enough of them, whether they've got motor vehicles, whether they've got access to the tools of their trade. I speak to labor inspectors all day, and I know what's going on there. There's a cry for help from the inspectorate. I don't know about other departments, but it certainly is in the labor department. There's an absolute cry for help. I'm not saying, Mr. Williams, that we've scrapped the labor law. That's the last thing. I started off this debate by saying that we have some of the best labor laws in the world. We're very proud of our labor laws. I go to labor law conferences around the world. I've just been to one in New York. And I was very proud to stand up and show our Labor Relations Act and explain that the premise of our Labor Relations Act is one of negotiation and consultation. We don't just force people into a court. We talk. And it's revolutionary around the world. Most first world countries can't believe that we've got something so forward-thinking. But let's not go backwards. Let's not force everyone into a courtroom and take away the right to negotiate, the right to appeal, the right to challenge. Let's not take that away and force everyone into a court. And that's all I'm saying. So I'm not saying scrap the labor laws, anything but. I'm saying use our labor laws, enforce them. Maybe someone's not listening to me. I strongly believe in the Constitution. I have a great belief in the Constitution. I think most of us sitting over here have a great belief, and we're very proud of our Constitution, and we don't want to break it. But our Constitution is not saying business as usual. That's not what it's saying. Our Constitution respects the Parliament and its lawmaking abilities. That we understand. But what we also understand at the end of the day is that we all want to live under the Constitution. And in living under the Constitution, we do need to look at certain factors. We need to talk, we need to debate, we need to say it can't be business as usual in the sense that businesses, the reality is businesses are not investing. Why aren't they doing it? We need to ask those questions. We need to find out how we can get them to invest. And we're not saying scrap the laws. We're saying let's make sure that there's a way forward. Yes, if you want to have a look at certain issues, we can certainly start looking at issues. Someone brought up the idea of the equity commission. And that they don't comply, they put up their own plans, and then they don't comply to their plans. And I understand that. And yes, we should punish those businesses. If it's their own plan, we have to punish them. No one's saying don't do it. All I'm saying is that we need the inspectors to actually catch everyone that isn't complying. I don't know how many people have actually been fined and brought to court for not complying with their employment equity targets. I don't know what the rules are, and I don't understand how many businesses have actually been brought to court. And I challenge you to answer me and to tell me how many businesses are actually not complying and how many businesses have actually been fined because of that. It's a handful. I promise you that there are many more out there that haven't complied with their equity plans, and it's very unfair on those that are complying with their equity plans. So this is a cry from the business community saying, please, let's be equal to everyone. Let's make sure that those that don't comply actually get caught. Because I don't know how many businesses are there here in the Cape. 10,000? Do you think they're all complying with their equity plans? Do you think even 1,000 have got equity plans? I don't think so. So let's do this hand in hand with the business community. There's a hand of friendship from the business community to Parliament saying, let's work together, let's move forward together and make this work. In terms of the deregistration, it's a perfect example. If you deregister a private enterprise because you feel they've done wrong, the only way they can challenge that deregistration is by going to court. If they're going to go to court, they're deregistered in the meantime. It means the business is dead 2 years later by the time they get to court. And no business is going to last for 2 years having been deregistered. So they can't do business for 2 years. They wait to go to court. Eventually a court might say, actually, what you did is not wrong. Because that's the other arm of our government. The judiciary. The judiciary might say, no, this business is fine. You actually haven't broken the law. You can now go do it. But they'll be dead by then. It's 2 years later. All the business community is saying is, let them have a quick, simple process. Maybe let them even trade while they're going to challenge it. Get it to court as quickly as possible. But the way the law reads now, the amendments, is that deregistration means that they'll have to be moribund until they've been to court, and then they can start practicing thereafter. I don't know how anyone could do that. In terms of the RIA, the RIA, what's holding you back? Why can't you have a regulatory assessment? Why not? I don't understand it. You had one right at the beginning with a different set of wording, completely different set of wording. It is different. And if anyone's going to tell me it's not different, that's not true. So we've got a different set of wording. With that different set of wording, let the same people who did the first, it was appointed by government, who did the assessment, let them do the assessment again. It doesn't take them all that long. It's not that expensive. Do it. Let's have a look. At least we can all understand. Sorry I'm taking so much time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, sir. Just
yes, I apologize. You did ask that question. I didn't answer it. Yes, I did come up with that. And yes, our Minister of Finance did say that, and he was correct when he said it, that there are billions of rands being held up in investments but not invested into South Africa, into their own businesses. And I answered that by saying that there's a perception in the business community that the returns won't be good. That perception, we need to dispel that perception. We want to work, and especially at the Cape Chamber of Commerce and Industry, our future is here. We want to dispel that perception. Yes, there have been international reports. In the last international report, they said that South Africa is number 144 out of 145 of the hiring and firing laws. Now, I think that's wrong. That's the perception out there. That's the assessments that were done internationally. When a business wants to come and invest and they have a look at that report and they say, well, we're number 144, we're second last on the list for the hiring and firing, means of hiring and firing. I don't believe that's correct. What we need to do is we need to hold hands with the business community, with the Department of Labor, and go out to the international community, and that's not true. That's why I made that joke and said that there's a perception out there that it's easier to divorce your wife than it is to fire someone. I don't believe that's true. What I'm saying to you is that we need to dispel that perception. We would like the business community to invest more here. Because if they do, then we'll grow our numbers. If our president said that we need 5 million more jobs, which he did say, he's absolutely correct. But what it boils down to is all you need is 1 million more small businesses. And then we'll have, because they've got to then employ people. Then we'll have a growing economy. Why is it that the growth in South Africa is worse than the rest of the growth in the rest of Africa? There must be a reason. I don't know, I'm not an economist, but I know that the growth in all our neighbors is so much greater, other than Zimbabwe. Yeah.
Just some few points of emphasis. I think we all agree that there is a need for to increase the budget of the Department of Labor. In fact, I think we were unanimous as a portfolio committee during the budget for debate that there is a need to increase the budget of the Department of Labor. And one of the areas which you have raised, which we fully agree with, is not only more inspectors, but training of the inspectors, their resourcing, and also better salaries for the inspectors. So I think we're in unison with regards to that. Just so that the inspectors are able to ensure that the exposed businesses which are not complying with the laws, and also that they are able to enforce these laws. But I think what I find quite interesting is the fact that we want to categorize the breaking of the law by businesses differently from the breaking of the law by individuals, by citizens. There's this big debate now about the collusion that happened in the construction sector, which is referred to as white collar crime, or collusion by construction companies, and it's not referred to as a criminal activity, and I think you made almost a similar point today that the intention of the amendment of this law, which we agree with as a portfolio committee, is basically to criminalize non-compliance. If there is non-compliance, it's criminal. You're committing crime on the laws of the country, and I think we need to put it that way. If it's settled in court, then let it be. If it's settled through the CCMA, let it be. But I do not think that we should beat about a bush and say, let's keep the battle, let's not bring in the Rolls Royce, because we think, in fact, if you bring in the Rolls Royce, if people realize the severity of the punishment if they do not comply, we think that they will comply. But yes, I agree with you that there need to be measures put in place to ensure that there's compliance, and part of that compliance includes more inspectors. But if it is criminal, let's call it criminal, and let it be treated as criminal, because even where there has been compliance, or even where inspectors expose non-compliance, some of the businesses completely ignored the orders which the Department of Labor imposed, what the inspectors imposed. And we did an oversight visit to the farms here in the Western Cape, where inspectors told us that they've been to the farm 2-3-4 times. They've been issuing order after order onto the farm, but the farm owners are not willing to comply with those orders. So we think that in as much as there must be compliance, monitored and enforced, but we think that the severity of the compliance is not enough. But I think what is, well, the other thing which I think we have to be emphatic about is the role of NEDLAC. I've just asked for the report, just we've received this report, and I've asked for the report again, just to refresh my memory. And for instance, on the Employment Equity Act, business disagrees, I think, with 2 or 3 points, 4 points. But what you said here is completely different from what business has said in the negotiation chamber. You actually think that we don't need these laws, this new amendment. In fact, your exact phrase was, why fix it if it ain't broke, why fix it? You know, so it illustrates that there can be negotiations there at NEDLAC, but you will still come here and present your own view, you know, as business or as labor and so forth and so forth. And we accept that in as much as we are given processes, which we will take into consideration at the portfolio committee, we accept that you still want to amplify why you have certain views. And we don't want to discriminate, you know, against you for holding such views. So I'm just doing that just to illustrate the fact that it is, in as much as that process is important, it is not only a certain section of the parties in NEDLAC who wants to still amplify their views, but also that we as a portfolio committee, we still really want to apply our might, and I think we agree on that. Then the issue of the regulatory impact assessment. What we have now before us is a product of the outcome of the regulatory impact assessment. So, and I think what we're proposing is that there must be based, we must go back to the same people and say, have we complied with what you said? And I mean, we had this debate over and over again with the other laws and all of that. And what we finally said was that if there's anyone who wants to do a RIA, and I'm sure there are members of Parliament who agrees with you that they need to be a regulatory impact assessment, and there are those who don't agree with you. But if you think that it needs to be done, business needs to do it, or COSATU or Solidarity needs to do it on their own. We think that these proposals comply with you know, those laws. And I think just a final point, with the understanding of the disclaimer which you made, that you're not an economist, you know, the one clarification being that the World Bank report did a study of, I think, more than 8 countries, and South Africa was one of the 10 in terms of what? Being flexible in terms of its labor market policy. But yet there are other reports which refute what the World Bank report had said. And you know, it's more a matter of perception rather than what is actually. And most of the international reports are relied on perception rather than on matters of fact. And also that South Africa is still the biggest economy in the continent. Of course, the other economies, they have 4 other countries in the continent which are the fastest growing, but our country is the largest economy in the continent. And with that, brings us to the end of the submission. Okay. We'll make an exception.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. That's why really this one needs to be clarified. I think the example the presenter has made in relation to Parliament changing what has been agreed at that, he made an example of 2 months or 6 months. That is not true. The report that was received, there was no agreement, and that is in reference to temporary employment service in terms of the government. So the party presented the picture that they presented, with due respect, it's not true. It's not true because labor at that rate was sitting at zero, and business was sitting at 24 months. And that is the department that suggested 6 months. And there was no agreement at that level in relation to that. So I thought it's important that it is clear Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Can we leave it at that? I think that was quite vibrant engagement, and I'm definite that we are going to open on the same note that we close on tomorrow, when we have Solidarity Research Unit presenting and Busa later on. But thank you very much to the Cape Chamber of Business Advocate. Oh, Mr. Bedell. And to colleagues, honourable members of Member of Parliament, in particular Mr. William with an S, and everybody else, thank you. Tomorrow we're resuming at 9 o'clock, exactly. And we have received some apologies. We'll present those tomorrow. So thank you, and see you tomorrow. Yes.